Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Hyundai, supporting the drive to keep our distance. chse.ie for more. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Hyundai, supporting the drive to keep our distance. chse.ie for more.
Good morning and you're very welcome to the show, and I hope you're having a good day today. I think a lot of people find that Sunday is not the easiest day, and Monday also is not the easiest day, but we'll make your Sunday, hopefully make it a bit more interesting for the next couple of hours. So the papers, do you want the good news or the bad news? I jest, of course. I suppose the good news is that our colleagues in the print industry are still putting out bulging papers every week. And I know that a lot of them doing it under very difficult circumstances and from home and not seeing each other and all that kind of thing. So great papers again today. The Sunday Independent has a very striking picture on the front. It kind of reminds you of, you know, that René Magritte picture, the Son of Man, with the bowler hatted guy with the apple in front of his face. This is a bowler hatted funeral director, Robert Maguire, and he has a very fancy looking face mask on. And that is the funeral of John Gallagher. John Gallagher, who is a community leader in Dublin, was Deputy Lord Mayor of Dublin. And there's a great story inside from Alan O'Keefe about the send-off that John Gallagher got, which was not the send-off that John Gallagher would have got in any other circumstances. But that is one thing that has been becoming a reality for a lot of people, is that the ending of this story and the ending of the story of people's lives in this time, people with COVID and indeed people with not COVID, it is not the ending that anyone deserves. The lead story in the Sunday Independent is A Nation Changed Utterly. So, look, we're being softened up across the papers and across the media, as you will have heard, for these measures to go on after next week. So the Sunday Independent, the crisis has not peaked, may not do so for another 2 weeks. Tony Houlihan saying that we need to keep it going. We need to flatten the curve even more than we have. And they're saying from this week, doctors will be posted, GPs this is, are being put on the front line, to the first of 40 community assessment centres which are scheduled to open across the country for patients who have or are assumed to have the virus. And I think those people will then be sent to hospital, told to self-isolate at home, or sent to a self-isolation accommodation centre provided by the government. That's like that. Like that centre in City West. The Sunday Times, virus spreading through packed asylum centres. So you could be suspicious that the asylum centres and direct provision centres are the next nursing homes. We saw this time probably last week, we were starting to get an idea that this is something that was going through nursing homes. Now it seems to be kicking off in direct provision centres, and like the government are taking measures now and getting hospital beds and everything else and trying to deal with this. But I think what it shows us is that in some ways this is a virus of kind of privilege and non-privilege, in the sense that I think a lot of us who have homes that we can stay in splendid isolation are probably relatively safe next to people who live in an environment like a nursing home or a direct provision centre. The Sunday Times also has, it's amazing, we saw the obvious effects this would have at the beginning, and then every day you see more effects in different ways that it has on people's lives. Women fear missing out on families in IVF freeze. So that is, and you know, this is like women who feel that they have a limited window of opportunity here. IVF is so hard. Everyone would tell you that this is probably the last thing those people needed. And then they have that Mick McCarthy gets the boot early as Kenny takes Ireland team. So Mick McCarthy's tenure as Republic of Ireland football manager cut short as a result of the coronavirus, and the under 21 manager Stephen Kenny is taking over with immediate effect. Less you're worried about Mick, he will still get his 1.13 million exit fee as part of his package. And but I guess the FAI will be saving money for a few months. I think it was July Mick McCarthy was supposed to go, because McCarthy was on an annual salary of 1.2 million, while Kenny will be paid just 540,000. The Business Post, HSE ordered large amounts of PPE from China, unfit for use by frontline staff. You might have seen it on the news the other night. The head of the HSE being asked kind of repeatedly by Katrina Perry what proportion of this stuff is no good, and he seemed to be not wanting to say how much of it. According to this, to Susan Mitchell, a health editor in the Business Post, so this internal HSE audit shows that four of the 10 items assessed, which included coveralls, goggles, visors, masks and respirators, were described as unsuitable or not suitable for use in a clinical or healthcare setting. One healthcare staff on the ground says it wasn't clear whether what we received were painter's overalls or were fluid repellent and something suitable for a hospital environment. It's sounding more and more, you'd have to say, and I'm not being smart here, it's sounding more and more like this is like buying dodgy knockoff mulberry bags or something from China, that it seems to be very hard to tell what you're getting and where you're getting it from, etc. That's what it sounds like from the outside. The Business Post also have Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael plan for business boost ahead of income tax cuts to aid recovery. So basically, it does kind of sound sensible that they will focus on getting businesses back up and running rather than putting money into punters' pockets. The Irish Mail on Sunday plans to exit lockdown on a county basis. So again, they are saying that the lockdown's restrictions will continue for a fortnight beyond Easter and might only be lifted on a phased regional or county basis. And of course, there's a worry that this would cause trouble because Dublin obviously is the, if there is an epicentre in Ireland, Dublin is our epicentre of this. So that would mean Dublin could be locked down for longer than other places under that plan. The government is considering a range of measures to ease restrictions before irreversible economic damage sets in. And that's very much a theme everywhere as well, that obviously, the longer this goes on, a more chance that things are broken that cannot be easily fixed again. I think the V-shaped recovery has gone out the window now. I see Colin McCarthy in the Sunday Times is talking about a Nike swoosh shaped recovery, which is like a very fast down and then a very slow gradual back up again. The Sunday World, the Sunday Mirror and the Irish Sun on Sunday all lead with the story about Robbie Lawler, who was murdered, and he was the guy who was suspected of killing Cian Mulready Woods. And finally, just the Sunday Telegraph have a big quote from the Queen. Those who come after us will say that the Britons of this generation were as strong as any. The Queen, due to address the nation tonight, to invoke the spirit of the Blitz, etc., and keep things up. Now, we are continuing to whittle down our live panellists in line with social distancing and everything else. So today we have two panellists in the studio. We have on Skype, then we have Mairead McGuinness, who's Vice President of the European Parliament and, of course, Fine Gael MEP. And on the phone, we have Seamus Coffey, who's a UCC economist and, of course, former head of the Fiscal Advisory Council. And then in studio with me, Michael O'Keefe, consultant ophthalmologist, and Michelle Murphy of Social Justice Ireland. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Morning.
Seamus, you
morning,
there?
Brendan.
Yeah, okay. So, look, I just be conscious that the two of you who are on the line do not be afraid to kind of muck in there, because I can't always see that you want to come in. So, now, if we try and start here on, I don't want to bludgeon people over the head with this for, it's been a long week, and I don't want to bludgeon people over the head with it for the next hour. There is something going on here, is there not? I was looking at Conor Skehan's piece in the Sunday Independent today, Modern Ireland Adapting to Become Its Own Hero. And he's talking about how this is an accelerant for emerging successful change in our society. There's no fuss here. We're good people. And that we have a sense now of being part of something bigger here, and that is very good for national kind of mood. What do you think of that, Mairead McGuinness?
Good morning, everyone. I'm much more sanguine on that. I think, yeah, there's definitely been a sense we're all in this together. We're doing the right thing because we know we have to, and we hope it will work. But if you read in detail the papers today, I think there's also a little bit of a mood creeping in, wondering how long does this go on? What happens afterwards? And those questions,
Mairead,
I think
we're going to talk plenty about that. I just wanted to try for 2 minutes before we go there. And I'm not remotely suggesting that this is a good thing or anything, because I think, you know, it's easy for people to intellectualize about this when they don't have a relative on a ventilator, or they have, don't have a funeral they can't go to. But is there, well, I think, is there some sense, though, that there's some, there is something going on out there?
Oh, there is, because we've all been stopped in our tracks. The things that we thought were absolutely essential and places to go and people to see, we can't do any of those. So I think we've more time to think. Sometimes that's good and sometimes it's bad. We've more time to reflect on whether the way we were is as good as it gets, or could we develop something better? I think that's an interesting one, because people are working from home. They don't have the long commutes, but they have other pressures because their children are at home. So I think, yeah, we're probably reassessing the way we've been living today. And maybe after this ends, and whenever that is, we might take some of the good lessons out of it. I mean, that's the upside. I think the downside, you know, if you look at reports about domestic violence and pressures on children and those things, I don't think we can forget the real world either.
Absolutely. I'm not suggesting that for a minute. I'm suggesting this is one particular thread of it. Michelle Murphy, sure. You were looking at, there's an extraordinary piece in the Sunday Independent by Maeve Sheehan, Some Heroes Wield Mops. Just tell us a bit of the granular detail there about what these hospital cleaners are doing and how they're living.
Well, yes, so this is a piece by Maeve Sheehan, and it's on, you know, the other frontline staff that don't necessarily get the headlines, which are the cleaning staff. And it goes through, she speaks to a number of cleaners, and it goes through the what they have to do before they enter each room, the amount of personal protective equipment they have to put on. They put on latex gloves, then they put sterilizer and sanitizer on those gloves, another set of gloves again. They go into the room, they clean it from top to bottom, and this goes on and on throughout the day and night. Then a number of, they go home, they take off their clothes in their back garden or the front door, they put it into a plastic bag, tie the bag, go straight in, have a shower, new clothes, clothes are washed on a hot wash. And these are people who are not getting paid significant sums of money, yet they're doing this day in, day out. There's retail workers, there are delivery drivers, there are people stacking shelves up and down the country that are doing this. They're, you know, they are contributing to the national effort, and they don't necessarily get the headlines they should get. So I just thought it was a fascinating story and a really good insight to the other part of the front line as well. And, absolutely, you know, the dangers that people are putting themselves into every day of the week.
And Seamus Coffey, there is extraordinary adaptability going on here, isn't there, within the economy? Conor Skeehan mentions on Post at the end of his piece, and the Daily Mail have a good piece about postmen and what they're doing. David McRedman was in very early on with this, kind of thinking outside the box and going, OK, well, we have a situation here where our post people call to everyone in the country. Let's mobilise that.
Yeah, I think Conor is likely onto something about the sort of the general, what we might call it, the goodness of people. Now, it's very visible at the moment, obviously, with the restrictions that people are following. But I think, by and large, it happens at a very local level. That you have this sort of overall contribution to society. And it's not all about markets, it's not all about economics, it's not all about buying and selling. But a lot of people's lives is actually doing good at a general level, whether it's running the local GAA club or contributing to tidy towns. It tends to happen at a small parish level. What we're seeing now is it happening at a national level. And you say overall bodies, like on Post, stepping up, like David McRedmond, getting into government buildings, making the announcement of the postmen and women knocking on people's doors, asking them, did they need something? Of course, the postcard that we've all received, that we've been able to send to people. And I think that overall level of goodness is that maybe at times the discussion in normal times can be dominated by the crude sort of practice of the sort of economic side of life. But there's no doubt that the other, more social side of life is there. I know that it's stopped. We're all seeing the impact of it.
Yeah, and you can't ignore the economy, but you know this argument that people make a lot, we live in a society, not an economy, we're certainly seeing that right now. Michael O'Keefe, another kind of textural thing that's been going on in our lives, Brenda Power has a beautiful piece in the Sunday Times about funerals and about the death of her sister when she was very young.
Yeah, this is actually relevant in my case, Brendan, because my brother-in-law died yesterday morning at 6 a.m.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
He had cancer and he was in the hospice. And as you know, hospice, I've always said, is one of the best parts of our healthcare system in spite of all the other parts falling apart. But his wife only saw him for 1 hour a few days before he died. He died alone in the hospice. His sons never were allowed in to see him. And so I picked this out from Brenda Parr because, and exactly as you say, very relevant. And I thought, my God, and the hospice are fantastic, but they were only acting under orders. I just think that if people can wear protective clothing to see and look after, it's no reason in the world why his wife, his kids could not have worn protective clothing to see him. And I think that's something that should be changed, in my view.
So there were no goodbyes.
No goodbyes, Brenda. He died alone in the hospice at 5 to 6 yesterday morning.
Was there a suspicion that he had COVID-19?
No, none whatsoever. None that I know of. I mean, the hospice people were fantastic. Yeah. Like, let's not. But I mean, this is the reality. And his wife, I mean, obviously there was a chance maybe before he expired his last breath that she would become, but that didn't happen. You can't obviously plan these in such a way that someone is going to be right there when someone just expires. And the result is the trauma of this is enormous. And this is not, I mean, she's not the only one, Brendan. This has been happening. I'm sure other people, I'm not the exception saying this, but that needs to change in my view.
Yeah, so get people kitted out.
Yeah, get people kitted out. If they're confident of the kids, for heaven's sake, what's the problem? Yeah. If someone isn't, and if the people, the relatives, are not COVID positive or have no indication that they might be, and I mean, either the kit is good or it's not good. I know we've had all the other things which you'll probably come to.
Yeah, and we'll come to that. Yeah, Mairead McGuinness, have we gone a bit far on this whole notion of the? I know we're going to up the numbers who can go to a funeral, but this notion of people not being able to say goodbye, the ending of life is such an important part of life. I know we choose to ignore it most of the time, we're all quite aware of it at the moment, and we are denying people that ending. We're sending life is ending with very, very sour taste and terrible sadness for people.
Yeah, I think it's terrible. It's in every parish, and somebody knows somebody who's been through this experience. And it seems a little bit harsh that where there is no infection, that there are such harsh restrictions. But equally, I've known of some elderly people who need to get into hospital under emergency circumstances, nothing to do with the virus. Nobody could go with them. And nobody could go in to see them. So I think it's having a very tough effect on families at the worst possible times in their lives. I mean, there are two funerals in our parish here, and this is a rural parish where I live, and normally we would be out there in force, and nobody was this time. And it does feel wrong. It feels very cold. And yet we're doing it, we think, for all the right reasons. But certainly when somebody is dying, for a family to be denied any contact with them is incredibly harsh.
So I mean, you'd agree that has to change, doesn't it?
Well, I feel if we can change it, we should change it, because it's what happens at death and around funerals funny stays with you for a long time. And any of us who've had grief in a family know that. So, I mean, with these restrictions, not to be able to be there, even to hold a hand of someone, it just seems harrowing, to say the least. And my sadness or my condolences to all those who would have suffered and are suffering, because life goes on as normal as death does as well, sadly, in the midst of all this crisis with the virus.
Okay, you can text us on 51551 and email us at brendan@rte.ie. Now, the kind of one of the harder stories of the morning now, in terms of harder news, is the protective clothing discussion that's been going on for the last few days. And Susan Mitchell has that extraordinary story in the Sunday Business Post of that audit. Michael O'Keefe, what do you make of this?
Oh, I think that's an absolute... the fact that nearly half the clothing we brought in is faulty is incredible. I mean, surely we should have been able to check that beforehand.
But you see, they can't check it. You heard the pilots on the Late Late the other night. They're basically saying they arrive... Somebody is allowed to stay within the footprint of the plane, I think. The stuff that gets loaded on, most of them can't get off the plane and they have to go.
But surely there's a virtual way of checking it, Brendan. There must be a virtual way. I mean, nobody would buy anything like that. 200 million and find that it's all faulty. I mean, not all faulty, but half it. And I thought, moving on from that, Brendan, I thought the most incredible thing, I saw the Taoiseach of this country on the phone to the Prime Minister of China during the week, thanking him. And then I listened to the HSE. And, you know, I'm be careful because I'm only raising issues. People are doing their best. And they're saying that, like, the Chinese ambassador had become the HSE's best friend. Now, China, in my view, this is the third virus it has inflicted on the world, and this time it's got us all. And China was pretty behind the curve in terms of telling everybody. But I thought one of the greatest, you're asking me about the Times today, and I thought this was a really good one from Jackie Danny Healy-Ray. The Taoiseach thanked the Chinese for giving us PPE stuff. I would thank the Chinese as well if they had kept their viruses. I
thought that was okay. And look, we want to be careful about we don't.
Yeah,
we,
yeah. But what I'm saying is that we
this is not a Chinese virus. Like it's a virus that emerged in China.
Well, we don't know. Look, we've got to, when this is all over, and I hate to say it, we've got to take to the Chinese and stop all these absolute appalling markets that they sell all these exotic animals. They eat them. This is totally unnatural, and this is animal viruses coming into humans. And I mean, okay, it's maybe I'm upsetting people by saying it, but this has to be said.
Brendan.
Mairead.
Yeah, I think there are two points to be made there. You know, we are in an emergency, and I think we will have to, after this is over, analyse exactly what happened, where it came from. But David Quinn in the Sunday Times has quite a strong piece about China and its role in this, and whether the information coming out from their crisis were accurate, whether the figures were accurate or not. But I do agree with the point about animal markets, wild animals, this crossover between animal and human health.
But Marie, is this a case of we want cheap goods from China, we wanted iPhones, we wanted iPhone parts, we never asked China any hard questions, did we?
I agree with you. I think we collectively liked the fact of what you could get. We perhaps didn't look at what that involves.
And a lot of people would say, as Michael says there, we still appear to be tiptoeing around the Chinese even at the moment, fating them and thanking them for, you know, sending us these faulty goods.
Yeah, and there's a bit of anger, for example, in Italy with the way the European Union has or has not reacted and China has come in to help them. So there's a lot of propaganda going on in all of this. But if you whittle back the issue, it now is an emergency. We will need to understand how it happened. Your point about whether it will change us in the future after this passes, whether we will still look perhaps only at price rather than value and what's going on in supply chains. We had already started that, for example, in pharmaceuticals, and Ireland is a huge manufacturer, global leader in this. We were relying, as the rest of Europe is, on India and China for the, if you like, the raw materials for many of our pharmaceuticals. And last autumn, I had raised this before coronavirus took hold because there was beginning to be a shortage of drugs. So I think on that issue, we definitely are going to have to review our supply chains. But okay. We can't Seamus just Coffey. Do it ourselves. It has to be a global response.
Seamus, we see now overnight that the Chinese are now donating ventilators to New York, and the mayor, governor of New York, I think one or both of them, is out thanking their good friends, the Chinese, and everything. The Chinese are really managing to make hay at the moment out of this, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. I think a quite extraordinary interview took place a couple of weeks ago from a senior executive in the World Health Organization, where he was questioned about the response in Taiwan to the COVID-19 and the coronavirus. Mm-hmm. And he essentially ignored the existence of Taiwan as a separate place and kept referring to the Chinese response. And the interviewer kept going back and saying, no, I'm interested in what's happening on Taiwan, a separate island, and the response they took at the World Health Organization, that they would not talk about a large part of the world on behalf or sort of as a result of pressure on China and China's refusal to recognise Taiwan. So I think it is having a very large effect, as Michael said, it is the source of this virus, but definitely is pushing a geopolitical agenda through this crisis.
But Brendan, could I just, Mairead, the article, this is a brilliant article, Forensically in the Extreme by David Quinn. Anybody should read this. But in the final thing he says here, but Taiwan was much wiser about things. It did not believe the official reports coming out of Beijing, and it did not follow the WHO advice. It went its own way and began screening passengers arriving from Wuhan on December the 31st. 3 days later, Taiwan implemented its emergency response plan to the virus outbreak. So in other words, here's a country that lives next to China. They knew well what China was up to. And that's what Taiwan did.
Yeah, Michelle.
Well, I just think Michael made a very good point there earlier that surely there must be a virtual way to give the measurements of the type of equipment you need. We also
and the broader issue of the Chinese and their behaviour in all of this.
Well, I suppose Seamus does make a good point that they're now making hay, and I think when this crisis is over, I think Mike Ryan of the WHO has made some very valid points that when this is over, all of our health systems need to be better prepared for pandemics, and that requires an open sharing of information, of data, of what is needed to address these pandemics. And one could question how open perhaps some of that data sharing and information sharing has been, not just from China, but from other countries. And if we're going to meet any future challenges to our public health systems internationally, we need to look at what sort of information we're sharing and what's best practice.
Okay, so like... Maria, does the EU have to start dealing with China in a different manner? Like, Donald Trump gets terrible criticism for taking a hard line with China, but do we all need to be taking a harder line with them after this?
I think we do need to take a hard line, but I think what's happened globally is tragic. If you look at the leader of the free world, the president of the United States, if you see what happens, and there's a story, I think, in the Sunday Indo about piracy, the Germans accusing the US of taking masks that were destined for Germany and shipping them off to the US instead. So we have a breakdown in global leadership at a time when we absolutely need global leadership and local action. One of the things that
perhaps... neither of our superpowers really are covering themselves in glory here.
Exactly, because you need cohesion globally and it doesn't exist. I mean, that is the tragedy of this. And if you look at the UK...
Yeah, and look, do we even have cohesion in the EU? But we might come to that in a minute.
One minor point, though. The European Union has a huge competence when it comes to animal health issues. When it comes to public health and health generally, it's a member state competence. And I think we're going to have to look at that because we were found wanting in terms of watching what was happening globally, preparing before it happened, and being cohesive when the virus took hold.
Who is bailing out the Italians right now? It's not the EU. As far as the Italians are concerned, it's China.
Yes,
I want to read a few texts on what we were talking about earlier, right? Someone said, Pat and Glasnevin makes a point, you know, about the cleaners being frontline workers as well. Pat and Glasnevin says, retail is creaking at the seams. Staff are worn out sick, brackets non-virus, receiving verbal abuse in stores. Customers are visiting convenience stores 2 and 3 times a day. Time for shorter hours, and I think all stores should close for a full day next Sunday. And there is no question that I think a lot of people now find they go to their supermarket and they try and get in and out as fast as they can. People are finding it an extremely stressful environment. Can you imagine being in there all day, dealing with people who are kind of on edge and I would say moving unpredictably as well? So let's not forget our retail staff as well. Someone is saying there, it just struck me that the wonderful cleaners can enter a hospital room of a dying patient, yet the grieving family can't say goodbye to a loved one. And I'm not sure that the cleaners are going in while people are there. So someone's saying we cannot endanger other patients in hospices by allowing people in to see their dying relatives. The greater good is what matters. A texter from Carlos saying, my wife's mother is dying from cancer. My wife has been in to see her. Her family are with her the whole time. It's a small HSE centre in Carlow. So obviously people are taking a local approach to this possibly. Now, I suppose the other big theme across the papers today is that of the lockdown. How long will it continue? But I think particularly in terms of the trade-off between lockdown and economy. So Seamus Coffey, Kira Kelly has a piece in the Sunday Independent. She's not an economist, but she's making the point we need to improve our battle plan. She's talking about, you know, the immunity testing, which it now seems is further off than we might have thought. She's talking about... you know, masks for everyone and just trying to move into this transitional phase that Mike Ryan and everybody else talks about. I suppose first, Seamus, it's very hard to do a cost-benefit analysis on this. You don't want to be cold, but we are saving, benefiting on one side, we don't know what, and paying on the other side in terms of the economy, we don't know what either. Would that be fair to say?
Oh, absolutely. I think the big thing, if you're trying to do something like that, is just working out the duration, the length of time these measures will be in place. Like, we know they're imposing a huge and significant cost in the economy. They're imposing a large cost on the government in terms of funding a large share of the economy. But without knowing the duration, it's very difficult to pin down exactly where the balance between costs and benefits lies. I think over the short term, it is something that can be sustained. But this was to go on for a number of months. That level of sustainability would come into question. And I think there's near universal agreement that you have to move to that sort of transitional phase where these restrictions are relaxed over a period of time.
When does that need to happen, do you think, as from an economic point of view? When does it need to happen?
Well, I think that the public health element of it will determine that first from an economic perspective.
Okay, but if we took the public health out of it, from an economic perspective, when does it need to happen before there is serious, permanent, long-term damage done?
Oh, I think there will be long-term damage. Okay. There is businesses that closed a couple of weeks ago that are not going to open again. The government is going to have an overall level of debt that will be tens of billions higher than what we started off with. So there are going to be long-term effects. I think just from a government perspective, given the measures that have been announced and the likely impact on tax revenue, it's probably something that could be sustained for a period of 4, 5, 6 months. But then after that, the figures become so large and the level of support being offered becomes so large that it probably wouldn't be something that could be sustained. So you're looking maybe at that transitional phase, hopefully starting within the next 2 or 3 months, and it might then itself take 3 or 4 months longer. And then the economy can come back over that period, perhaps, but by the end of the year. But it won't be a quick bounce back. Like, the shutdown has been almost immediate, but any recovery such that it is will be take a bit longer.
Michael O'Keefe, coming from the medical, I bring in a second, right?
Yeah.
Michael O'Keefe, from the medical perspective, do we just have to suck up whatever damage economically is done now? There are a lot of people starting to make the point that the long-term health effects of crashing the economy like this.
Oh, I think they're going to be significant. You see, I think depression, all these things are going to happen. People hold up in their homes. And the worrying factor, I see, Neil Ferguson, who advises the British government, has said it'll be the end of May, June. And here, again, we've got to be careful because you'd be seen to be undermining the national interest. And we mustn't do that. But what we've got to do, we've got to start asking questions. What is our exit strategy? Do we have a plan B if this doesn't work? Can we let people back to work on a phased basis? How long will we get to the phase? Because I can't think we can flatten the curve without knowing how many people are infected. And we don't have the test numbers to know that at all at the moment. If you look at, I'm going to look at the paper today, we're only doing 1,500 tests a day. That's too few. We need to do many, many tests to know whether we're what the scale of the problem is, in my view. And then the other thing, Brendan, is that, and I saw it recently, there's a crowd in Northern Ireland who are making this kit where you can do antibody studies. And they're absolutely confident that their kit is going to work. And that's the other thing. We're great to be ready to go to know how many people have antibodies and whether they're immune and whether they can go back into the community and whether people can go back working, and those that have the condition and those that are at risk, you keep them out. But
what you're actually saying here is that herd immunity got a very bad name at the beginning of this, largely probably thanks to Neil Ferguson, who you mentioned there.
Yeah.
But that are we going to have to accept some version of herd immunity at some point? Because this needs to go through the whole population one way or another.
Well, Brendan, how long do we keep people locked up for? Exactly as you said, their mental health, all the other conditions that the other morbidities that are people going to have. Can we keep people locked up till June? I don't think we can. They'll be mad. I don't think people will tolerate it. And therefore, I think they need some hope. And something like saying to them, well, look, we have a strategy, strand B. We're going to do more tests. We're going to get people back into working again. As your economist said, we need to do this. Otherwise,
Mairead, where is the plan B? Where is the strategy? Like, because we're not hearing it.
Well, remember, we haven't dealt with this ever before in any of our lifetimes. So it is unprecedented. The only experience we have is the limited one from China, and we're not sure we're getting the full data there. So we have no choice here. We have to lock down to save lives, and the lives come before the economy. But of course, the economy is absolutely vital.
But the economy will cost lives, you would agree, wouldn't you? Poverty kills and poverty shortens lifespan, doesn't it?
It does, but thankfully we have measures in place now at least to help workers stick with employers to keep that link together. So there's no doubt the balance here is very, very delicate and very, very difficult. But I think the question of how long can you keep people locked up is a very serious one. We're only 1 week in and we're beginning to ask ourselves these questions now. What would it be like if it goes further? And yet that may well be the public health guidance.
But yet you're not aware of from the Europe or indeed from your Fine Gael connections in Ireland, you're not aware of an exit strategy or a plan B here, are you?
But there's several plans, and certainly at EU level.
Could you tell what are the exit strategies that you're aware of?
I'll tell you, the one worry we have is that there isn't a coherence at EU level around things like corona bonds or collective bonds across Europe. But that debate will continue.
Okay, in terms of an exit strategy of bringing the economy back to life, what are you aware of in Europe or in Ireland as a potential exit strategy being discussed?
Already the Commission have made announcements to deal with the current situation, to help countries deal with the current crisis.
Again, exit strategy. Do you know anything about an exit strategy?
Yeah, we do, insofar as we're all trying to find solutions, Brendan, to make sure that companies don't collapse, that businesses don't close in this lockdown.
In this period, are you aware of any exit strategy being mooted either in Europe or indeed by the government in Ireland?
Certainly at an EU level, the use of the ECB and the ESM, these mechanisms to provide credit to business is certainly in place, and more will be done and more will have to be done. I think the big question we all face,
that's about life support, but the exit strategy.
But remember, Brendan, if you don't keep businesses on life support, they won't exist after the crisis. So I think you can't just dismiss it as being irrelevant. There does have to be an enormous package when the economy can be kick-started again. Now, the difficulty is, and this hasn't been mentioned at all, is that there was supposed to be a strategy for climate and biodiversity that Europe was rolling out. And maybe we need to look at, can we do some of those things, given the fact that the crisis has closed down businesses, to reboot them in a way which also satisfies our long-term challenge of climate change and biodiversity loss.
It was in the air anyway, wasn't it, that the next big stimulus for Europe, because Europe was turning before this, and Germany was slipping into recession, that the next new deal in Europe could have been the green stimulus. Okay, thanks, Murray. Seamus, just before we leave this, I have to ask you about this. Matt Cooper starts his piece in the Business Post today saying, Seamus Coffey, the former chair of the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council and his colleagues of recent years on that voluntary body, might be justified in looking wryly at the respect and even deference the government is showing to Dr. Tony Holohan, the chief medical officer. They were never in receipt of anything like it. Discuss.
Yes, I saw that piece from Matt. And I suppose there is a very significantly different approach taken from the advice of the National Public Health Emergency Team and their daily briefings, and the government by and large following the advice that's been given. I suppose one thing you'd say is that in recent years with the Fiscal Advisory Council, you're dealing with budgetary decisions that were by and large involved in adjusting taxes down and increasing spending. And that's something that politicians and governments want to be seen to do on their own, not being influenced by the advice and the recommendations coming from Tony Holohan and his team are very much a negative. So you could argue that the governments are looking for the good news and trying to push the bad news on somebody else.
When they need the cover, it's expert advice. There was a very interesting thing I thought Sam McConkie said the other night. He was on television and somebody said to him, well, are you just listening are the government just being told what to do by the medics and that's it? So could anyone be in government? And he said, no, it's very important here. The government takes the advice, but then the government needs to make decisions on it based on the cost of the advice. And there is a substantial cost to this. And I thought it's interesting that if the expert medical community are starting to back off here slightly and saying, no, the government needs to take our advice with a pinch of salt. I just thought it was a kind of a little move on there and I wondered about it. Just before we go to a break, Paul Reid of the HSE has confirmed in a press conference this morning that 65% of the personal protective equipment that arrived here from China last week does meet the required specification for use here. So that's two-thirds of it. So a third of it, no good. Let's take a break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Hyundai. Supporting the drive to keep our distance. CHSE.ie for more.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us, Mairead McGuinness on Skype, Michelle Murphy and Michael O'Keefe in the studio with us, and Seamus Coffey is on the phone. And also on the phone now is Daniel McConnell, political editor of the Irish Examiner. Danny, good morning. So,
good morning, Brenda.
Where are we at with government formation?
Yeah, I suppose it's been described as a slow bicycle race. Certainly, the negotiations were 55, 56 days on from the general election on February 8th. And I suppose in the initial aftermath, we had this sort of posturing from all the political parties, with Fine Gael saying we're the third party, we're going into opposition. We had Mary Lou MacDonald and Sinn Féin saying that they had a right and a mandate for change and to be involved in that government. But and we've had various posturing from some of the smaller parties. But since then, the impact of COVID-19 has completely changed, the landscape that we now face.
So what we have now is we have a baseline, it would appear, of Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, who have a vague document, and now they need to put the other, to quote Michael Lowry, the other two legs on that stool. So what is it looking like the other legs on the stool will be? Labour Party have a new leader. Is he being vague enough? Is there a suggestion he might go in?
He's certainly keeping his powder dry as of now, given, I suppose, he's just taken over. Certainly speaking to senior Fine Gaelers and Fianna Fáilers over the last 24, 48 hours or so, there is a strong appetite to get the Greens in if they can, because they see their block of 12 votes as very attractive.
Danny, have we lost you? Okay, we've lost Danny there for the time being. Mairead McGuinness, so we have half a government, and now they need either the Greens or Labour and some independents. Would that be an accurate reading of the situation?
Well, we certainly, if Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael can agree a paper, there needs to be another party involved, plus others. I think that's clear if you're to have a stable government. But I saw commentary yesterday, which, you know, certainly I think has some elements of accuracy in it, that we could face another general election, because we had the, 65, 66 days ago, it seems like last year or years ago now, we have a government that's trying to deal with the crisis that clearly has a mandate, but a limited one, and is really taking on quite a lot of emergency measures to deal with the public health crisis, at the same time as trying to negotiate a programme for government. Yeah. So I'm not sure that we're going to get there. Now, I'm not as close to it as other colleagues in the party, okay, but I wouldn't be putting money on it.
Would another election, do you think Fine Gael might be thinking that that might be a good idea for them at this point, given that there was the poll in the Sunday Business Post last week showed Fine Gael kind of riding high?
No, I don't think so. I think it's easy for me to say another election because I wouldn't be in it. I think my colleagues are perhaps not looking at that at all. They're trying to see, can a government be formed? Other parties tried, apparently, and didn't achieve anything. So I do think we can't let this linger for too much longer.
Well, we can't anyway, legally, can we? We can't make any more laws, can we?
But even to your point, Brendan, where you were pressing and pressing for what's the plan to exit this, we do need that there's a political cohesion around the exit strategy after this virus, because we had a very different set of books going into this crisis. They would be completely shredded. And the next government, whoever leads it or whatever shape it has, will deal with very, very big challenges that they had not envisaged. And all of the manifestos will again have to go into the shredder. So it's very difficult to see all of the parties being coherent on what we're facing into, including those other issues I mentioned of climate and biodiversity, because they will not go away. And that's why, in a way, the Greens, in my view, they have an opportunity to bring those issues into government at a time when
we are going to have to do things anyway.
Look, it's not for me to say. I haven't read the piece in one of the papers with the leader of the Green Party. I'll have a look at it later. But if they are serious about wanting to change the way we live, work, play, whatever, towards a more sustainable future, the way you do that is by being in power and influencing
policy. But the Greens themselves don't seem to agree on that at the moment, do they? Mm-hmm. Michelle, what do you think?
Well, I actually think there's a very interesting piece on this in the Business Post by Aidan Regan, saying that the next government has a new, unique opportunity to reboot the Republic. And at the end, he states that parties should be clamouring to be into government now, given the opportunities that we have. And we do have a huge opportunity to reimagine our social contract. There was an editorial in the Financial Times yesterday by the editorial board that stated we needed a radical new social contract, that we needed to move past the policies that we've been pursuing for the past four decades and look at how you provide a better standard of living for everyone.
Well, how do you provide it when you've no money and when our national debt's gone through the roof and when we're running a massive deficit?
That is the purpose of the programme for government. So first, you look at what should the basis of the social contract be? I mean, how can you provide a better standard of living for everyone, at least a minimum social floor of income and services? You need a vibrant economy. You need decent services and infrastructure that are functioning now, but can it meet our future needs? You need a taxation system that's fair, that's just. You need good governance. People need to trust that the decisions you make are in their best interests. And there's sustainability. As Mairead said, it's environmental sustainability, biodiversity, but also economic and social sustainability. So we have an opportunity now to really rethink how our society functions and what, you know, there's a piece in the Sunday Independent.
What would Social Justice Ireland think we should keep out of what has happened recently, all these new measures we've brought in?
Well, in terms of measures, what we have shown is when there is a crisis, action can be taken. All the problems at a cost, but in advance of this crisis, we had problems in terms of housing, healthcare. They're well documented. Things that were said could not be done have been done. But when we look to the future, beyond this crisis, we need to look at things, investment, for example, public spending, how we provide quality, affordable, cost rental housing and build social housing. What's our minimum income floor for people? What's our minimum social floor? How can you
access? So should we look at keeping, like, for example, the so-called Corona dole of 350 quid a week everybody?
Well, that's a decision that was made to link the welfare payments to the Danish model and your wage income. But what it does mean is we have to reassess how our work system, our employment system, our welfare system and our taxation system interact. How you look at things like a universal basic income, for example, or looking at indexing social welfare payments to the minimum essential budget standards. Do we go back to a two-tier health system, for example, or do we accept a universal healthcare system? Are we going to put our resources into primary care? We're the only Western European country that doesn't have universal primary care. These are the kind of things that should be concentrating the minds. And in addition to that, you have your climate obligations and all the other obligations that we face.
Okay. Danny McConnell is back with us. But Michael O'Keefe, I just want to go to you on that. In terms of, we've been told there that we've got Sláinte Care by stealth or Sláinte Care on speed or whatever it is, that we now have a one-tier health system. What's your view on it?
Well, I don't think we have that at all at the moment. Basically, it'll take a few minutes, but by and large, what has happened in the last week is that the private hospitals have been nationalised for about 5 months. Understandably, the public system needs the private hospital beds and their ventilators and their ICUs, and the private hospitals are well-run, good hospitals.
So this had to be done?
I would think so. I mean, and the private hospital anywhere were donating all of that. They were already on board to offer all of that, and that's only fair. But what's happened now is that there are a lot of private patients because the public system has been poor and collapsed for years. And so there are 400 or 500 private doctors. They have lots of patients, including
These
myself.
These are consultants who work exclusively
in the private system.
Yeah. So you work exclusively
I do.
Privately.
I used to work in both, but when I retired, I work in the private.
Yeah.
And so from Monday on, all of these doctors were told, you can no longer see your private patients in private hospitals. They'll now have to be all put into the public waiting list. A public system that is, in my view, totally collapsed in time. It's been a basket case for ages. So all of these patients, including mine, I'm now having to see, what can I do for them? And I'm not exaggerating you, Brendan, and I sit here and I'm not shroud waving, but I believe a number of my patients, if this goes on, will go blind. And I tell you, and a number of other people's patients, because I've checked with them, and a number of other.
But Michael, if the public health system is supposed to be good enough for everybody else, should it not be good enough for your patients as well?
It's not good enough for everybody else. That's the problem. We've known that for ages. That's why all of these patients have left the public system to go private. That's the reason why, because the public system has been a basket case for ages. Waiting lists, not being seen, no follow up, and now all of these private patients are now being thrown into that mix again. private patients, hundreds of them, people who, so now the morbidity and even the mortality will rise up. It's not alone the virus which will kill people, but this will kill people. Look, I'm telling you in my own practice, if I can't see my patients next week, and there's a chance I won't be able because they're shutting down my private rooms, not a mind to being able to do anything, I will have patients go blind.
Okay.
It's as simple as that.
But you're also saying that people will die because of this.
Well,
is about saving lives.
Yeah, it's about saving lives.
Side,
I mean, I don't deal with people myself. I deal with eyes. But I spoke to others, people with bad rheumatoid disease, cardiac problems, respiratory problems. All of these are private patients. They've had to go private. And these now are faced with a dilemma. They'll be put back into the public system, Brendan. A public system that is non-existent.
Yeah, Brendan, Mairead, yeah.
Yeah, just, I'm getting depressed actually listening to Michael.
Do you take his point?
No, 2 points I want to make. I think the point that you, and we should repeat again, 65% of the PPE is actually fit for purpose.
Yeah, got that.
And that's
to Michael,
it's good
to
that
Michael's
we check.
Point.
The second point is that we are in this emergency and therefore we have to do things
right.
Now to make sure those who are critically ill can be looked after. The chief medical officer said there was no need for people with normal medical conditions and emergencies not to go into hospital because they are still looking after patients. So I do think we shouldn't frighten people by saying that, look, you're going to die because of this.
I'm not frightening, Mairead. I work in the system.
Maybe I
should frighten people because this is a serious, serious issue. I work in the system. I'm telling you for nothing. I'm not here. I don't alarm people. I'm not here shroud waving. I'm telling you, this is the reality that's going to happen. And you can take it or leave it.
But have you a solution? You're a medical
professional. I have a lot of solutions. Yeah. I think that people like
suggest that, I mean, give us some guidance here because we're all in this together. So
we
if
are,
you are
and
an
I'm
expert,
I'm in it
what
like
would
you
together? Advise for your patients?
Well, I'll tell you what I advise to my patients is that my patients should be allowed to see me in my private office and the matter private and other hospital and other people should, and likewise in other offices. I believe that the private system, which can give the beds, give the facilities to look after the COVID patients or the patients who are referred to them from the public system, that these hospitals should still be left open to see some of these patients and they should not be transferred into a public system that is not fit for purpose. And I'll tell you one further thing. In the Mater Hospital in Cork today, there are only four patients as inpatients. In the Mater Hospital in Dublin, there are only 70% of the beds are empty, Mairead. In the Bonsecours Hospital in Cork, they have only a handful of patients. So all of these beds...
Are they actual facts, Michael?
They are actual.
I checked them
last night.
Okay, Mairead, that seems like a waste of Michael's time and energy and skills.
I'm a bit tired of just listening to criticism. I think Michael made some very good points there at the end, and he should talk, and the medical system needs to address that issue. Nobody who has a medical complaint should be neglected in this crisis.
No, and they shouldn't be more aid. That's the whole point of my argument. Don't speak over each other.
Okay, Mairead, will you finish up?
Yeah, I think we agree on that. I don't think there's any disagreement. I think what Michael needs to do with his colleagues, because they're the experts, is find a way to make sure that we deliver for everybody who is ill at this time in the best way we possibly can. And
yeah,
the private hospitals were needed.
Yeah,
and
but it is government decisions being taken, isn't it? I don't think Michael was, by the sounds of him, Mairead, I don't think he was included in
no,
the decision.
No.
Yeah,
but I'm sure they didn't ring Michael, but they would have taken guidance from the chief medical officer.
I know, but who's the chief?
Let's not get into personalising around the chief medical officer. Michelle.
The OECD has pointed out, like, one of the reasons that the Irish healthcare system is feeling such stress on this is we had a 95% bed occupancy rate in advance of the pandemic, and we only have 5 ICU beds per 100,000 of the population. So, and it's been pointed out over many years by the OECD and others that, you know, we're overly reliant on secondary and tertiary care. So the acute hospital system to deal with people's illnesses and various issues, things that we should be dealing with in the community sector, in primary care and in terms of launch care.
Do we take Michael's point that our private patients, and I can't quite believe I'm saying this, but are they being treated like second class citizens in this whole situation?
In terms of
what Michael has outlined there.
Well, I mean, our overarching goal for the health system is that you have a universal healthcare system and your access to healthcare is based on need, not based on income. That is a fundamental stepping stone that I would see and Social Clause Ireland would see as being the basis of the healthcare system. And one of the very first steps you need to make is invest in primary care, community care and step-down care facilities so you get people out of the acute hospital okay. system and they can be cared for in the community.
Okay, so Danny, I want to go to you briefly. Listening to this, why isn't there a clamour for everyone to go into government at this time of wonderful opportunity?
Well, I think there's a realisation, Brendan, that the national interest scarcely these days does much for your party's interest. And I think ultimately some of the smaller parties in particular have known from experience that, you know, going into government can have a devastating impact on your party standing. Look at the Labour Party, look at the Greens previously, look at the Progressive Democrats who are no longer with us. So there's a real realisation, and particularly if you're going to go in as the third or fourth wheel in any government, there's a real danger that you get swallowed up or subsumed by the bigger parties.
Owen Harris making the point today, I think, in the Sunday Independent, that the small parties could be rewarded for stepping up at this time. Seamus Coffey, can I finish up with you on this? There are huge challenges ahead here for a government in terms of Michelle, who is expressing what a lot of people think, like that this is an opportunity to change how we do business in this country. But on the other hand, that's stuff that's going to cost a lot of money at a time when we are not going to have a lot of money.
Yeah, and I think long-term changes in the overall approach aren't necessarily things that should be discussed now. Now we're in the midst of a crisis. It should be doing about what's best to get us through this. And then maybe after that, towards the end of that, you could look at some of these long-term changes. And if you look at the policies that have been introduced, that have been done on the fly, and yes, there's been mistakes made. But that's all understandable given the speed at which it's happening. But we also see that the cost of the measures being announced. Like, we get very excited every year about the annual budget, where the government maybe is looking at an overall change of in its public finances of 3.5 to 4 billion. In the last couple of weeks, the government has announced 7 or 8 billion of additional spending on health and social welfare, and tax revenue is likely to fall by as much. So we've seen 4 times the annual budget in the last 4 weeks. So I don't think we should be making long-term decisions on some of the short-term measures that have been introduced now.
Okay, I want to thank my panel at this point. That was Seamus Coffey, economist at UCC and also former head of the Irish Fiscal Council, Michael O'Keefe, consultant ophthalmologist, Michelle Murphy of Social Justice Ireland and Mairead McGuinness of Fine Gael and Vice President of the European Parliament. And thanks as well to Danny McConnell of the Irish Examiner. And now, coming up to 12, we'll take the news with Ciarán Ivrin.